On today's episode of M&A Launchpad, we interviewed Mike Okravu, where we talked about what it looks like to quit a tech job and go buy two simultaneous businesses at the same time, the importance of doing due diligence on your employees, why you need to increase expenses after buying a business, and last but not least, different ways to do seller financing. So Casey, what do you think of today's episode?
Go with your gut. That's what I've heard. I mean, he just went with his gut. He trusted his instincts and man, he's pulling it off.
No, I'll agree with you. I think one of the most important things people need to have in this business is have confidence in yourself, right? You're not going to know everything, but you need to know enough to be dangerous and know how to go solve the problems that will come up as you proceed through the business.
Absolutely.
All right. And so look forward to this episode. Welcome to the M&A Launchpad podcast with your host, Casey and Ferris with Equity Launchpad. On this podcast, you will gain insights on acquiring, investing in, and selling profitable businesses in the lower to middle market. Whether you're a business owner, investor, or aspiring entrepreneur, at Equity Launchpad, we will provide you with the knowledge, guidance, and capital to navigate the world of mergers and acquisitions. All right, everybody, welcome to the M&A Launchpad. And today's guest, we have Mike Okravu. Mike is a first-time buyer. His background actually is in tech, similar to myself, and basically, he bought his first business and then quickly bought a second business. So breaking a lot of the rules of the game, doing, you know, multiple things at the same time and really not sticking to the standard model. So it's going to be interesting to talk to that. He is the owner of an epoxy coating and towing business, which will be the focus of today's conversation. So, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. You know, it's exciting to hear a little bit. You know, I always enjoy talking about tech guys and just really talking about what they did in tech and really what led to them to kind of start to make that path to the M&A side of things. And so really for today, I think, you know, for our listeners, can you give a quick just 30-second overview about what you were doing in tech? And then from that, really, let's start talking about how you transitioned into M&A, what gave you the exposure and how you started to learn about kind of that whole ecosystem.
Yeah. So I've been in tech for probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And I got into tech because, you know, there was some point in my life where my father owned businesses. He was a doctor. He opened up, but he left, you know, the hospitals he was working at, opened up his own practices, actually like urgent care, string of urgent care clinics. And I was always very impressed by that. And you know, at some point he died, unfortunately. That was like the worst moment of my life. And I had to take over his businesses. But I didn't do very well because not only was I literally like the day after he died, I had to take on that burden to try to like figure out how are we going to wind this down? How are we going to sell this? What are we going to do with this? You know, but I'm not a doctor. So it was kind of hard.
How old were you?
I was 28 and I'm 35. Right. I was 35 now. So, you know, eventually I was able to wind that down and kind of just whatever, liquidate what we could and get as much from it as we could. But then I was like, all right, what am I going to do? And I'm kind of an opportunist, right? So I talked to some friends and I was like, what am I going to do? They worked at tech companies. And I started learning about the different types of roles that only existed in SaaS companies, which were like post-sales roles. Like you sell a SaaS product, B2B, and then you need someone to manage it. And that's how I got into account management and customer success. How I got my first role was, I don't even know how. But once you get in, that door opens, everything changes, right? So I kind of rode this wave for a while of like the tech boom, which was really like started at the time that I was, you know, looking. And so I've been in customer success roles. I worked for two public companies. One of them is called WalkMe, and then one of them is called Asana. I've worked for smaller companies, Series A and a Series C company too. And then
so
I got laid off.
Let me interrupt you there. So not the traditional even tech journey, right? You know, a lot of people think tech means you have to be a developer, you have to have a computer science degree. Really, you were on, what people forget is that's just such a small piece of tech, right? 80% of tech companies is really the servicing, the maintenance, the support, and all of that. And so how you stumbled in, you got into that, you were a CSM, is that right? Customer success manager?
I started as an account manager, but it was like, there's some companies have kind of like blended gray areas between account managers and CSM. So I would say CSM is fair to say. But officially, I was an account manager.
So, Mike, you're more on the sales. I mean, you're a sales guy.
I've done sales. Yeah. Let's put it this way. I've always had a variable quota to hit, which is common for CSMs and account managers. So, yeah. And hey, I mean, if you like, I was going to say something about my, you know, if you see my wife, she's like a million times more beautiful than me. So like, that's how you know I'm a good salesperson. Yeah. but also like, just look, the way I got in, I mean, I don't know. A lot of people listen to me and their first impression of me is like, oh, you're like a fast talking New Yorker. Like you could probably talk your way into anything. And I don't think of myself that way, but that must have been what happened, because I don't know why else they gave me a chance. I basically just was like, all right, here's my transferable skills. And that was, those were back in the days when like interviews were all like in person and stuff. I don't know, but I just know that if once the door opens, then everything changes, because then you're like a tech guy. And so the next tech company is going to be like, cool, we want to hire that exact archetype of what the role we're looking for. And then it's just,
it's almost sad where if you have one tech company on your resume, you are infinitely easier to get interviews with all the other companies. I mean, even 100%. To this date, I still get hit up from all of the previous large FANG companies that I've interviewed with asking if I want to go work there. And, you know, but okay, continue on.
So that eventually what happened was I was at Asana last year.
And for those that don't know, Asana is a project management piece of software. Yeah. We actually do use it throughout our companies. And so it really helps people get organized around projects and tasks and tons of integrations, just to kind of,
I like Asana. I actually use it in one of my businesses now. I mean, you know, I'm still a little, don't get me wrong, I'm still a little bit bitter, but I like it. I like it a lot. And it was a huge hit during the pandemic. I'm pretty sure they actually went public in 2020, if I recall correctly. And obviously they just like exploded from there, and their competitors like monday.com is a huge one. But anyway, then of course, everything just changed so fast. It was like this rocket ship because of COVID, and then like a crash. And you know, Sana was like every other company. They laid people off. They laid me off. I didn't understand why even. And they don't tell you why, because of HR reasons. Like, I was one of the only people on my team to hit my quota. You can tell I'm bitter about this, right? But it's okay, because what happened was, I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to take my severance. I was able to get another job in like 2 weeks. So it wasn't, I can't really go out there and say like, oh, woe was me. Like, not woe was me. But it catalyzed something where I was like, I'm not going to let somebody else control my fate anymore. I'd rather go down swinging myself than have somebody else determine where I go.
Absolutely. And that's always the risks that working at companies, right? And even leaving Microsoft, people called me crazy of wanting to go do my own thing. You have this safe, plushy job at a tech company or other tech companies. You know, what's going to drive you to make you want to leave? And so definitely know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So then I guess, so really, what was the resource that, I mean, so you, Asana let you go. I guess that led you to start thinking about, okay, how do I stop becoming dependent on one specific company, right? Did you have friends that had bought businesses, or what was the thing that gave you the exposure into the space?
I didn't even know, like, this sounds so stupid. I didn't even know people bought businesses. Like, I know that, like, of course, in like mid-market and like above. Yeah, of course. You know, there's tons of funds out there, private equity. I know that. But I didn't think that just like people like me just went and bought businesses, because I assumed you had to have, you know, just be very have cash rich. And obviously I wasn't, because I was laid off. So, you know, I was like, what kind of business am I possibly going to buy? Like, that's not realistic. Even if I were to buy one, you know, the amount of capital it would take, would just, the risk is just crazy. And then what type of business would you actually get for, I don't know, like, you know, a couple hundred thousand or something like that. I didn't even know there was different ways to structure deals and all that stuff. But what happened was, I came across Cody Sanchez on Twitter. And I think I really credit Cody, because her content is like really good for opening up your eyes, where you're like, oh, I didn't even know this was possible. And I started to research and I kind of was like, maybe it's not possible. And then I realized it was. And the way I realized it was possible was, I basically, so this was like November, December, I was laid off. By January-ish, about this time a year ago, I was like, okay, like, I can do this. And so the first step, I was starting to talk to banks. And that was really what opened my eyes to what's possible. Because if you can't get financing, you can't get anything. But if you can get financing, then, you know, then you're, it's like you can go shopping, you know, it's like having a, an approval letter for like a mortgage or something, you know,
gives you that confidence. You're like,
yeah. Yeah, I can go shopping. I know I can probably get this. Of course, it's not done till it's done, but you know that you're qualified as a buyer, you know, what requirements are going to have for capital injection or whatever. So the first bank I spoke to really was disheartened. Like, it was a disheartening experience, because they were like, well, we want you to have industry experience and whatever you're doing. And if you don't, you probably want to bring on a partner, but then they're going to have to be on a person PG it and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that doesn't even make sense. Like, I don't even know what business I'm looking to buy. Obviously, I just care about cash flow. which is something that Cody Sanchez talked about. You know, she was like, I don't care what it is, as long as it makes money. And in my head, I was like, yeah, exactly. Right. We don't care what it is. And if you talk to both.
Yeah. The banks don't, they want to know that you have some experience in what you're doing. Right.
And there you go. And, but that's the thing. So the first bank made me feel like, nah, I don't know if this is going to work, because just practically speaking, how was I supposed to look for a company, which, you know, those deals may not even pan out. Right. And then if it doesn't pan out, I'm not going to stick to the same industry. That's way too narrow. So I'm supposed to get a partner, bring them on, make an agreement with them before trying to get to LOI. And then, you know what I mean? It just didn't make sense. So I kind of gave up for a while, but it's only when I started talking to more and more banks. And I started doing that once I found the first companies that I was interested in. And those are actually the companies that I ended up buying.
No, and for those listeners, I mean, the bank is your biggest partner on these deals typically, right? So you need to find a bank that you like. It's not just about getting a term sheet. We've made that mistake in the past, right? On the real estate side, where we went with the best term sheet that we were given versus the best partner, because that partner can make it 10 times more onerous to run and manage that business. And so definitely get out there and talk to different banks. And, you know, we'll share some resources on the podcast as well around different banks, different, you know, companies that we've worked with. And really that is a huge part of the business plan. Plus it gives you the confidence boost and helps you define, if you don't have a clear box, it helps you get a clearer box based on what the bank is willing to do. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but just like the, one of the deals that I was looking at, they had been SBA pre-qualified. You know, you'll come across a lot of businesses like that, which basically just means like they've reviewed the financials and they say that it cash flows. And if you have a certain amount of money and you're a qualified buyer, the bank will fund the deal. And so because of that, that led me to another bank and they were like, no, we don't care about your resume. They literally said, we don't need your resume. If you want to send it, you can. So immediately that took a whole big roadblock out of the way for me. And I don't know if you guys want to hear about how I did my search, like my process. No,
absolutely.
But
what did the bank, you know, so you mentioned that the bank let you get out of obviously needing a pre-existing experience there, right? What did the bank ultimately, what was the box they defined for you, right? What dollar amounts, how big of a loan, how much down payment were they going to require? And was it specific industries or did they just leave it industry agnostic?
So this was like, I found a company on BizBuySell that was listed there. And by the way, if you go on BizBuySell, there's a way you have to do it, but I can get into that later if you want. But so I found a company on there and they had been SBA pre-qualified by a certain bank. So I liked the deal. So that's the bank I went to. And the numbers were the listing price for that business. This is on small side was $495,000. Okay. And it was doing like 411K in EBITDA. And I'm not even kidding. That was
1x multiple. Like, I'll buy that all day.
It's a crazy multiple. And most people would run away from that. That's like, that's the thing. Like I know most searchers are like way too paranoid for that. And I understand, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't be, but I was like, I looked for certain proxies to make me feel better about it. But anyway, going back to the bank, you know, they wanted like, and I know now I could have done a better deal with a different bank, but they wanted like 11 or 12% capital equity injection. And I had that money. Okay. And I was like, cool. Like, okay, let's do it. Then I was, you know, I had a good credit and everything. And I was like, all right. So I knew that was probably going to work out.
So your box was roughly, again, you put in 50K, you can buy 500K business, right? Keep it simple.
Exactly.
That's the mindset you had.
And now I know I could do it way differently. I could buy a bigger business for that. There's all different ways to structure the deals, but I just wasn't aware of at the time.
Stellar Carries will allow you to get a lot of extra leverage with the SBA.
No, and we bought a business where we have six different pieces in the capital stack to make the deal work. And so everybody walks home happy in that case. So I tell people you can buy any business out there for almost any price if I can get the right capital stack.
But Mike, I mean, I've got 20 years in the finance side. That's what got me into the acquisitions, you know, putting deals together for clients that were like, I'm like, I can't believe I found the money. And, and then I was like, well, I need to do this for myself. And that's the natural progression.
Now that I know, it's going to inform business number three, which I am working on. But yeah, like you only know what you know at the time. And I was like, all right, I guess this is what it is, you know? And if that's the other thing, it's really hard to find good information on, you know, searchers and ETA, like, because those terms, I didn't even know what those terms were. When I came across Cody Sanchez, if you don't have the terminology, how are you supposed to find information? I promise you, like, forget that you know the term ETA or searcher or whatever, and try to find anything. You'll come across like SBA 7A loan. And the SBA 7A loan, the information that's publicly available will tell you to structure the deal exactly how I did. It doesn't tell you that there's other ways to do it because that's not the standard way, you know? So you have to really talk to advisors and banks and like different people. And that was like a big part of it, was like just learning what these things were even called.
That's why we do this podcast. I think I learned just as much from the audience as they learn from people we're interviewing as they learn from us. So you learn something, a different nugget from everybody.
And I'll add it for the listeners too, is, you know, that's why, especially with SBA, working with a finance broker is very helpful, because the only way they can get paid is by the bank, right? So you're not going to pay a lot of fees to work with a broker, but they're supposed to be your, you know, they're really your Sherpa, right? They're walking you through the loan process. So finding a good loan broker, somebody that understands the finance process, it's how I made a living for a very long time, can really help you get through that process.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, okay. So you kind of had your buy box. So ultimately, where'd you land and how'd you find them?
Okay. Yeah. So I'll quickly go into the process of how I did my search, because a lot of people ask me that. I try to keep it simple. I said, I'm looking for a business with a certain amount of cash flow, or SDE, I guess. And, you know, these industries. So I had like a list of like, I don't know, 8 to 10 industries that I would consider. And I knew which ones I wouldn't consider. It was still a broad search. But what happened was I basically just went to BizBuySell and started documenting across those industries. And BizBuySell has actually a pretty good search function if you don't use like just like their standard drop down boxes. Mm-hmm. So I was able to find a lot of businesses. And what I was looking for was two things. One, did it meet the basic criteria of like, you know, SDE or whatever? And secondly, was the seller motivated? And the way I was able to determine that was, I mean, if they're offering seller financing, they're probably motivated. If they're retiring, they're probably motivated. Because I knew I would probably be able to get the better terms that way. What happens in practice when you do that? So I had this big spreadsheet of all these different companies. Like when you actually start to reach out to them, you see that most of those listings are actually outdated.
Yeah.
And the way you'll find that is if you look and like try to go to the broker site, you have to maybe like Google them or Google their name. You'll see if it's listed or not. And sometimes it's under contract or sometimes not listed at all. Then you're done. So when it actually came down to it, it looked like it was this huge potential market of companies, but actually it was a much smaller pool.
Okay. And so I do got to ask. So, I mean, for our side, tracking your pipeline is so important, right? For anyone out there that's even looking to start finding, you need to be diligent and organize all the leads and, you know, have a status for them. And it's funny, our first pipeline way back when was an Asana Kanban, right? That we basically tracked them all. And so did you track your stuff through an actual pipeline or CRM, or were you just kind of spreadsheets and picking up the phone and doing what you need to do?
Okay, so this is going to probably reflect poorly on me in terms of my impulsivity, but or impulsiveness, whatever. But like literally the first like couple deals that I came across, those are the ones I ended up buying. And so I didn't really track that communication, because as soon as I started talking to those brokers and like doing some like preliminary due diligence, pre-LOI due diligence, I was already interested in those. So if I had to do it where I was tracking communications, I would probably use Asana, because spreadsheets just, I don't know, drive me nuts.
All right. And so which business did you find first? And both of them came off of BizBuySell? Yeah.
Both came off BizBuySell. The first one was the garage flooring company, and it was listed by a local broker in that area. It had the SBA pre-qualification and everything. It had a very good multiple. Now at this point, I didn't really have, you know, people can judge me, whatever, but I did things my way. I was like, I have the capital to, you know, buy the business and do the equity injection and maybe have some left over or whatever, but I don't have that much like put together like an advisory team. And this is $500,000 deal. Now, one thing a lot of people don't know is that when you're doing deals that are sub 1 million, things change. Okay. You can't expect the same level of due diligence, because the seller can't even produce the level of due diligence that you want. So if you want to know like just something basic, like, hey, can you break down your lead sources for me from customer leads? Like, they won't even have that information. So you have to temper your expectations when you're doing the sub $1 million deals anyway. And I didn't have the money to like do whatever I needed to do, like, you know, Q of E and like all this other stuff. So I was basically, and I'm not recommending this, but I was basically using the broker like as my advisor. I was, at first I saw him kind of like an adversary, but then I was like, he actually has the same interest as me. You know, he wants to get this done. And so he was helping me, you know, with everything I needed. Luckily he was very experienced. So just no, something that people should be aware of.
And it's very valid, right? The smaller the business, whether you're buying real estate, whether you're buying a business, or whether you're buying something else, usually the lower level of sophistication, right? Because they're smaller dollars. Yeah. So small dollars don't warrant cash to go spend on more complex tools. And to be honest, even the larger business that we bought, you would think there would be a little bit more back office there than what you would think for such a large business. And so as we were talking kind of pre the show, right? Even the most largest of businesses, sometimes, you know, back office aren't as sophisticated as they first come off the pier.
So Mike, looking back though, I know how I did on my first acquisition. Do you wish that you would have done the quality of earnings?
No, so this is what I did. I used proxies to basically say, okay, like, this is how I'm going to tell if this is a good business or not. So I did my own kind of Q of E, just like kind of like spot checking like several transactions across like the ledger and like the CRM and all this other stuff. So I was like, okay, they checked out. But what really stood out to me was the actual tax filing, like literally dollar for dollar matched the SDE that they were advertising. So this guy actually paid taxes on $411,000 of income. And I was like, well, he wouldn't, I mean, unless you're a very sophisticated fraudster, like you wouldn't do that if you weren't actually making that much money. So I kind of like took that at face value to a degree. Again, right, not saying I'm proud of it.
So one of the things I would say on the quality of earnings, though, just for any of the listeners, I highly recommend it, because I wish on my first acquisition I would have done a quality of earnings, just because there's a deeper dive into the past performance of the financials. And yeah, it's 15 grand. It's expensive, right? And you can use Guardian, and there's several vendors out there that do it. But for us in our second acquisition, the quality of earnings really, really helped us, especially when you start talking about networking capital and how much accounts receivables and all of that stuff you're going to leave with the business or negotiate. That quality of earnings really did help us do that part of it. So anyways.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you a deeper perspective, right? And it really helps you thread the needle on a closing, right? Because now you have data to go back to the seller and say, hey, you do need to leave this much business and this much in the business, and here's why, right? And sellers, it's hard for them to negotiate.
That would be hard at the sub $1 million level, but I think you're so right, Casey. Like one thing, I don't actually know if this is a scope for a Q of E, but like one thing I wish I would have understood better, that's hard to tell just if you don't know what you're doing, if you're not a finance guy, is just like the seasonality of the business. Because some businesses are obvious with their seasonality, but some of them are not so obvious, because it might be like a 20% like dip, but then maybe because you have the type of business where you're taking deposits up front for future work, you don't see that. You look at like top line revenue and it's the same, but it actually like it, your lead flow is completely different and your revenue cycle time is completely different, you know? So that was something I didn't have any insight to. And I really wish I did, because as soon as I took over, I was like, holy shit, where's all the money? You know,
that happens usually.
Yeah.
So the business you said was about 420,000 of NOI, right? And ultimately how much revenue was that off of?
It was about 900,000, which is also a crazy multiple. Like most people would walk away from it. We're actually on track to do like 1.2 now I mean,
so
yeah,
real quick, for those listeners, let me just kind of clean this up a little bit. So 900,000 of revenue whenever you bought it. And how long have you had the business now?
About exactly 6 months. It was June
6 30th, months, and you're on track to do 1.2. So about a good 25% increase or so. And on the revenue side, and then your margin sounds like about 40%. So you're running a pretty healthy margin.
Not anymore.
Yeah. And so, walk through that. So you've obviously, to get that revenue, the increase in revenue, you've started spending more. And I'm guessing the seller was probably not spending as much as they could to make it. What you said, fraud?
No, I was saying he was very involved. Involved in the delivery.
All right. Okay. And no, so then what expense items did you start adding into the business, right? And what are you, what are you looking at margins wise now?
Yeah. So the first thing I knew is that I was going to take a salary, because I wasn't going to, I didn't know when I was going to be able to take payments, but I knew I should take a nominal salary. I mean, I take 48,000. It's not whatever. Like, and if I had to, I would just take it off if we were not cash flowing. So I knew that I was going to have that.
420K number of NOI was not including seller salary.
I think he was just reporting it as like pass-through income. Like, I think that's what he was doing. Yeah. So a couple things I knew and a couple things I didn't know that came to pass that cost me more money. So one, I knew I was going to really ramp up our marketing efforts because, you know, like most people want to buy a business. We're tech guys. That's easy for us. If you're doing like anything digital marketing or whatever, like I knew how to, and especially in local markets, it's like the bar is so low. You can really like dominate a local market. Going back to, and this just really quickly, one aside, going back to like some of the proxies I used to kind of determine if the business was good or not, they had, and they still have, like 200 five-star Google reviews with nothing under 5 stars. And I was like, that's really hard to fake. Like people putting up pictures of their garage floors and stuff. Like there's a business here. Like there's no doubt. It has to be. Uh-huh. But anyway, so I knew I was going to ramp up our marketing efforts. So the first thing I did was I changed our domain name. I got a new website, stuff that people don't like to do. Or a lot of people were like, no, don't change anything for like 6 months. And in my head, I'm like, why though? I know this needs to be changed. So I'm going to change it. So that probably layered on maybe like just for the 20, maybe, I don't know, $5,000 to $6,000 a month just for that stuff. So I knew that was going to come out. I also knew that I was going to have to hire someone to replace the work that the owner had been doing. So I knew I was going to bring on, I actually hired someone before closing. And, you know, basically I wanted to have someone there that I knew wouldn't leave that, you know, cause like, I didn't really get to due diligence the employees and people.
How many employees were there?
Find that there were, I think there were like four, at the time, including the owner. So most, I don't know if this is just small deals, but most sellers are very paranoid about having you do due diligence on the employees. They're like, don't talk to my employees. And I'm like, yeah, but that's a huge risk. In hindsight, like the main guy who was doing all the installations, like he was, first of all, he was paid very, very, very well, but he had actually started his own company, like doing this on the side on the weekends. And I was like,
in the same business, same industry.
Yeah. And I was like, and he wasn't even there the first, oh my God, it was crazy. He wasn't even there. He was on vacation the first week I took over. So I couldn't even talk to him. So I found this out from like the other installer that he works with. And I was like, holy shit. Like this is they don't think it's a big deal. To me, it's like the cardinal sin of like being an employee. Yeah. But to them, they're like, yeah, it's fine. I do it on the side. You make money. I make money. It's all good. And I'm like, no, like, you know, and I came to find out that he was actually like promoting himself to our customers, giving his own business cards out and stuff. So huge risks there. Shocker. That definitely I would. You have to insist on a key employee due diligence. It's just not non-negotiable. There's too much risk. Because if he would have said, you know what, I've been starting my own thing for a while now, and now that you're here, I feel like it's a good time for me to just walk out, that would have sunken us. Like that could have happened in another universe. I'm sorry, I know I got off track. You want me to go back into the expenses I was layering on?
Uh-huh. Well, no, I have a question about the employee.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, so did you fire him?
Eventually he left on his own. I couldn't fire him for a while because I couldn't find a suitable replacement, which is crazy, you know? And some people would say, well, why didn't you just get your hands dirty and go in there and do it? Because it takes a long time and that's not where my time's best spent, especially when I have two businesses. So, that was really tough.
And we'll move to the second business here in a second, but where's your time spent right now on that first business? Is it purely on the digital marketing side? And, you know, kind of the delivery side is pretty much doing its thing and you're just really out there kind of sourcing on the lead side. Back to your roots.
A lot of it goes to lead sourcing. I'm so sorry if you hear my child in the background. It's, by the way, problem. I had a baby in December. So on top of everything else,
everything hits you at one time, man.
I know. But it's like, I feel like you're like this, Casey, like, you know, from what you told me before we started recording, like, you know, I feel like you just have to trust that you're going to figure it out. Like that's like what it all comes down to. Like, I can't know everything that's going to happen. I don't have a crystal ball, but I know myself well enough to know that like, I'm going to figure out a solution, whatever it is. Even if that means pivoting, even if that means you know, selling the business to an employee and having them seller financing it to them or whatever, or, you know, starting a new line of business or getting a job if I had to, right? What's the point of all those years I have in tech if I can't go get a job? And so adding a baby to that, it just, I just like, would I recommend it? I don't know. Probably not, but I know I'm going to figure it out. You know what I mean?
That's what it takes. It's that entrepreneurial, man. That's
fantastic.
So before we go on to second business, last question. Have you been happy with that acquisition?
I am happy with it. It does cash flow well. You asked me about current margins. Current margins are probably now more like, probably more like 25%, I would say. Yeah. And some of the other costs that ended up happening is that we have a sales guy. I have him do all the sales now, whereas the owner before was like taking some of them himself. I don't want to do them. Like, I don't want to go on, like, I want him to handle everything. So that's another probably like 50 or 60 grand. And hiring someone else, that's been it. And then also, I think the other thing is, like, if you're going to get into a business that does any kind of specialized work, you really, really need to make sure there's people there that can train the next person and bring someone on, because I lost so much money. Like, that's why I'm not impressed with my revenue numbers, because revenue is growing because I'm a good marketer, I guess. But like, I lost so much money from poor quality of work or having to go back and fix things or extra materials and stuff. And like, you know, it just like, it just, that just sinks you. Like, money's like oxygen to your business, especially when you buy it. So
stumble forward, and the School of Hard Knocks is the best school of all. So definitely the name of the game.
And when you're doing consumer based work, it's like they have all the power. So keep that in mind. Business is audience.
So for those
listening, here's my question. So the Google reviews, are they staying strong?
Oh yeah. Yeah. But they are staying strong, but if it just takes one and then you start to erode equity, brand equity value, you know?
Absolutely. But I mean, hey, you're doing all the things people tell you not to do, right? Don't go for a business that does basically non-recurring revenue, right? Yours is just fixed project-based business, right? Smaller business. So you have very few employees and very few tribal knowledge, right? So one person leaves, you have a big gap, and ultimately, you know, you step in, right? You kind of have confidence yourself and you just roll forward, right? And again, that's what I tell people. There's not a right and wrong way to do things, right? It's about doing it your way and then ultimately figuring out how do you move forward and continue to build kind of that vision and just having the confidence of that you either know how to figure it out or you know someone that knows how to figure it out. And so,
what I like, Mike, is your vision on, you know, having more than one company, right? That was your mindset going into this. I'm not just buying one company. I'm going to buy multiple companies. And so that allows you to go, hey, I learned from number one and now I'm going to go to number two. Now yours is different though. You didn't really have a lot of time to learn from number one because you jumped in right behind that with number two. So talk to us about that move.
Crazy. Like just think about it from like a logistical standpoint. If you're doing two acquisitions, you have to time them so that there's no overlap between the transition periods, right? Like I can't like, you know, have one transition period start while the other one's still going, because that transition period is like gold. You'll never get it back. Seller's gone. Yeah. You know what I mean? And they weren't very long transition period. It was 3 weeks for the garage flooring company. One of those weeks was taken up by the fact that the key guy was on vacation. So the seller was like taking his role for a week. So a whole week was gone. And so like, you know, that even that part's like crazy, like trying to manage that. And then you're worried if one guy finds out about the other company or one bank finds out about the other company, are they still going to want to go through with it? It's like, there's a lot of stuff there to manage. But basically the other company I had come across during my search was a towing company. And this towing company was very interesting. It was only about like 700,000 in revenue, or that's what they said. They don't even know. Okay. Like that, it was like that, like, and maybe 300K in SDE. And I was like, okay. Talk to the broker, and the broker's like, look, be honest with you. On paper, it doesn't look like this company makes a lot of money, but in reality, it does. It's just that it may not all be, I don't know, maybe it's not all reported, or maybe the guy's doing creative counting, who knows, but something that like would make it impossible for you to go to the bank and get like an SBA loan. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I tried to do that, and that took 3.5 months. So like around the same time, around April, I was like started the process, and I went into LOI and for the towing business, And then by mid-July, after that point, the deal should have been closed by a bank. They were like, oh, we got a new head of underwriting and he doesn't want to touch this deal. Sorry. So the deal was, it was 700K revenue, about 300K SDE. I was buying it for 550 and the seller was going to finance, I think 150K of it was 150K he was going to finance.
Were there assets? Like I would take with the towing company and trucks.
Yeah, exactly. There were. And that's one of the things that I basically looked at this and like, listen, most searchers and banks would run. They'd be like, whoa, not clean books. Like, I don't want to touch that. What else are they hiding? But like, I looked a little bit deeper and I said, okay, here's a seller who's a little bit paranoid, a little bit like off the grid kind of guy, you know, like, like never made his company to be sellable, you know, just wanted to whatever, run it or whatever until he didn't want to run it anymore. And if I just buy this and clean it up, the multiples on towing companies are very high, usually like 5X. If I just buy it and clean it up and do nothing else, already I'm unlocking a lot of value there. So I had to look at it a different way. I said to myself, okay, there's those assets that you said, the equipment value is about 250K at least. So already 250K of this is going to be covered by that no matter what. Like I could sell those trucks today for that much. And, you know, like I knew that he had contracts that were, you couldn't really fake contracts with roadside assistance companies like Geico, Allstate, big insurance companies like that. And also the police, local police departments. So, the, you know, the police departments say, hey, there's an accident. Come and pick up this car or something, you know. And I knew he had those. So I was like, as long as those contracts stay in place and they're transferable, like we have something here. I don't know. I kind of took a bit of a dive. Yeah.
Went with your gut. Yep.
Huh? Yeah. So what happened was basically after the bank said no, I was like, shit, I don't know what to do. I said, listen, Mr. Seller, I can go back to like another bank or something, but it's going to take another 3 months or so. Like, what do you want to do? And he just wanted out. I don't know why, but some life reason, he just wanted out. And so I was like, I told the broker, I said, look, I'm going to put together the best offer I can without using a bank. And it ended up being like, I put $100,000 down. The rest is financed to me, which
from the seller.
Again, the seller finance made me feel really good about it because I'm like, he wouldn't do that otherwise. Like, why would he do that? You know, so some people do maybe, but I was like, there's no way. So he's going to finance 83% of the company to me. There's no way that it's fraudulent or something. It would just make no sense for him, you know? And worst case, I'm out $100,000, which is a lot, but it's not like I'm not going to go into bankruptcy over that. No. So I was kind of reasoned that way to just assess the risk. And like you said, Casey, it was a hedge against the risk of just having one company. It was two bites of the apple. So I really wanted it.
And especially if you had the $250,000 of hard assets, right? I mean, the numbers start to make sense from your side of everything. And so what did he finance it at? What rate?
Okay, so this is where I really screwed up because I had all the leverage and I don't know what it was, but I'm so ashamed to say this, but I'm going to say it. I must have felt like, man, I'm getting such a good deal here that this guy has to finance this to me that I'm going to try to make him feel a little bit better about it. So I did very aggressive repayment terms at 4 years at 8%. Okay. Which has really, really narrowed our cash flow. Okay. Because I'm basically repaying like, you know, 11 grand a month. So that's a lot, you know what I mean? And we're doing it, but damn. But it's a great company. If I had to do it again.
Renegotiate. Always know you can go back and renegotiate. Pay them a year.
Maybe I will.
And then go back and tell them, hey, man, economy, blah, 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 renegotiate.
I think I have to because it's not that the business is able to support it, but it's just like, it just doesn't give you the cushion. So here's another thing.
Cash is king.
I want people to know about buying a business without a bank. It doesn't matter that business. So, okay, the towing company did a stock sale, not an asset sale, because all the contracts and stuff, I didn't want to have to go to the police department and say, hey, look, I'm the same company, but really it's a different company. Mm-hmm. You know, if they said, no, sorry, you're not the same company, like your LLC is a different company, then what? Then all the values eroded. So we did a stock sale. And the reason why that's important is because even if you do a stock sale, you don't get the benefit from any banks. So you want to go get a line of credit or something, you don't have it. You can't get it. You need at least 3 or 4 months of you know, banking statements and stuff like that, just to get a line of credit from, like, you know, one of those like tech companies like On Deck or something like that. So that's really
3 or 4 months is conservative. Usually it's like a year. So
yeah. So that's like, think about it. I put all my money into just making the deal work. I had very little left just for, like, you know, operations and stuff and working capital. And that's where we started. Okay, that was not a good idea on my part. But luckily, the business was from day one was just bringing in cash and stuff. So, like, I was like, okay, like it ended up working out. But you have to be aware of that, because SBA loans will give you the working capital loan line of credit. But, like, you know, doing seller financing, you have to negotiate that into the deal somehow.
Oh, and that's where, I mean, structuring those is always so critical. Even having like NOI triggers, where if the company's making this much, then I'll pay you more. But if it's making less positive cash flow, then I'll pay you less. And there's a lot of ways to do that. We could do a whole podcast on that. But before we run out of time, I guess two quick questions. Are you happy with that acquisition? Kind of given where you are now, you've gone through, you have a good pulse on the business. How do you feel about it?
I love towing. Honestly, it's the greatest thing. If you could find a towing company where the deal pencils and the math works, you're going to just love it, because you just get demand all the time. Like, I don't have to go generate demand. I just have to manage it. That's it. Every day we get tons of calls from Geico and Allstate and all those other places. Even like cash calls, which would be like you calling for a tow, and then plus the police calls. And it is fantastic. It's also not a super specialized skill to tow. Like, yeah, it is. Like, you have to learn, but it's not like I couldn't bring someone in who's reasonably physically fit and teach them how to tow cars. Of course you could. That's completely different from garage flooring. So I would say towing, love it. Garage flooring, I'm happy that I have it because I'm learning. But it helped. What it really helped me learn was what not to buy in the future.
Inbound versus outbound leads, right? It is very different world between those two. So,
you know, and that process that you're going through is all about that learning curve, right? And so there's not a school for this. You know, many of us didn't have, you know, all of the skill sets and all the things you need to be this considered super successful acquisition entrepreneur. But you got to go through the motion. And for those that are listening that haven't gone off the couch, they haven't closed the deal, you know, Mike's a perfect example of somebody that just went out and did it and is learning while he goes. And I'm telling you, it may not be your first business. It may not be your second business, but I am sure that we will touch base in the next time. And you're going to say, hey, I've got my third business.
I know. That's the question before we wrap up. I mean, you know, what's next for you? Are you just going to kind of hunker down where you are and just get these things a little bit more cash flowing, or are you already out there hunting for the third?
I am definitely working on getting them more cash flowing. Like, I'm already about to open up another yard for the towing company. I even launched a new brand for it that's separate. That's just like supposed to have like 5-star Google reviews, you know, none of like the impound stuff where people leave you 1-star reviews all the time. And with the garage flooring, I'm expanding into the Tampa area. And I've actually changed the model to be pretty much all subcontractors. So we're just like a sales and marketing company, which is good because I know how to do that. But the other stuff,
a lot of the roofing businesses are that exactly. Exact model.
Hey, man. It totally changed. And you know what? I just want to say this because I think a lot of people look at roofing and stuff. It totally changes the dynamic when you become the customer. So you become the subcontractor's customer, and now you don't pay them until they've done it the right way. Whereas if you're doing the delivery, the customer doesn't pay you until you've done it the right way. And you see what I mean? So I love the dynamic anyway. But the next one, I know that it's going to be something not super consumer facing, where someone's going to be like, oh my God, there's like a little like divot here. Like, what is that? And I'm like, yeah, it's your concrete floor. It's what it looked like before we coated it. You know, like that kind of stuff where you can't make them happy, but at the same time, you can't win by not making them happy. So those things would be like, and I'm just speaking out loud, I haven't found anything yet like this, but like septic tank cleaning, stuff like that. No one's going to be like, oh my God, you cleaned my septic tank poorly. They're only going to care about if you showed up on time. You know, I'm looking
boring, at things like dirty land jobs.
Yeah, there you go. Land clearing, demolition, Even things that are like super niche, like fuel hauling really interests me. That kind of stuff. Like I want something where it's like where the equipment cost is so high that that by itself is like a barrier to entry.
Barriers of entry are awesome. And that was really one of the things that was the most attractive about the chrome plating business we bought. I mean, there's a lot of machinery there and there's very few guys that are going to go in that space. And I was going to say, you know, one last thing before we wrap, right? Houston is the mecca of towing companies. And so you should definitely come check us out here and go find one here. You can come hang out with us.
I like that. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I love it.
So that said, let's move on to our rocket round. So, you know, for those listeners, right, we do three questions to every guest, the same three questions. So first question, what do you like to do in your free time?
So I have a baby, which you might hear. I don't know. I hear it. I honestly, it's crazy because I didn't even want, this is going to sound messed up. I didn't really want to be a dad. I was like, I'm not ready. I'm buying these businesses. But now that it happened, I just want to be with them all the time. I love hanging out with them. So I know it makes you a little bit boring, but if my baby wasn't here, I would definitely be like a Topgolf or anywhere where I can drink and play at the same time. All right. So that's my thing.
You're going to be that dad that tosses the kid in the towing truck next to him and teaches him how to go get the job.
Oh, done. Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So what's your most memorable moment in your business?
I think the most memorable moment was when I was able to actually take out money from the business, like aside from my salary. And I was like, wow, we have like a surplus of cash here. Like And I was like, okay, like here's
all
20 grand
until it happens.
Like,
right.
It's working. Yeah. Like, you know, like, look, the businesses are never going to cash flow how you think they're going to cash flow when you buy them. Like, I don't know. I don't see how that there's just so many things you don't know about until you get there. But like, that was a huge thing where I was like, yes, like something above and beyond, you know, is working here.
Some. And last but not least, favorite podcast or resource to kind of help you in the journey.
So I do like podcasts like this. There's another one that I listen to called Acquiring Minds, which is cool. I was on there. I really like the Prof G podcast with Scott Galloway. I feel like Scott Galloway just really talks to like tech guys. Like he really resonates with like the younger kind of tech guys, but he's very smart. He always gets you thinking and he has so much great commentary on like not just business stuff, but also like just kind of like social and world commentary too. So I really like Scott Galloway.
Awesome. Thank you very much. So I guess that said, last question before we wrap up, how can people get a hold of you?
So I'm on Twitter. It's Mike the Lummix. It looks like an anonymous account, but it's actually me. You can also email me at michaelcravi@gmail.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. So
what's the Lummix mean?
Honestly, I swear to God, it was like, I don't know what I was doing, but it was like an online persona I was going to make to like do podcasts, but like be able to like speak freely without being worried about like my tech companies, like, I don't know, like firing me for saying something like politically incorrect or something. I don't even know. And I just stuck with it. I'm like, you know, maybe I am a Lubbock sometimes. So anyway.
So Mike, I'm super impressed, man, with your story, what you were able to pull off and what you're continuing to do. It sounds like, man, you're going to be one of those guys that'll figure out whatever it takes to get to make the company profitable, make it work and get to your third company.
Thank you so much. I'm trying, man. But you know what? Like, I will also resign myself that whatever happens, happens. Like, I'm going to do my best, but that's all I can do.
And that attitude is what makes it great.
Yeah, absolutely. No, definitely look forward to hearing more on your journey up to come. So congratulations on the success and definitely look forward to speaking with you soon.
Congrats on
that. All right, y'all take care. All right,
thanks.
Got it. Thanks, Mike. Thank you for listening to the M&A Launchpad podcast. If you've enjoyed today's podcast and would like to support us, please leave us a rating and a review after you listen. If you're looking for guidance on your next business acquisition or sale, capital to support your next business transaction, or to invest in a private equity opportunity, visit equitylaunchpad.com to learn more and to connect with our team. If you know of an individual who would be a great guest for the show, head over to equitylaunchpad.com/nominate, where you'll have the chance to refer yourself or someone else to be a guest on our show. I'm Casey Minshew, and I look forward to talking with you next week.